This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, short for Sustainable Design, on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. I have an archive show for you, so this gives me a chance to give you a little background on me in explaining this archive. And what it is back in about in 95 at Warner Creek, I went out and recorded Mick Garvin, and then I also had Tim Ream on KWVA, because KLCC would not, and other stations would not, put these guys on about the Warner Creek tree sit, which turned into the Northwest Forest Plan. So, I have always had a calling for the trees. So when I grew up in a house, and you can look this up, the Manson family threw their gun over the hill three doors down from me, and Helter Skelter was filmed on my street. It's called Longview Valley Road. I lived in the very last house on Longview Valley Road, and the reason I'm saying this is it was 7/8 of an acre, and it had redwoods and eucalyptus trees in the backyard, and it was like a secret garden back there that I used to go into with the trees, and there was a felled tree that I called the rain tree. And there was this guy at the other end of the street, the other end of Longview Valley Road, is Knob Hill. He may still have it. He had a freshwater otter. And every year, this otter would show up at our house every spring because there was a spring back there. And I actually, one year we always had these torrential rains in California. And one year I went back there and actually fell in a hole that was from this seasonal spring that apparently was back there that Longview Valley Road was carved out of. So there's always been some calling for me for the trees. The trees called me, and I bought property up here in 1985 and then moved up here in 94. And because I didn't know that much about the trees, but I knew, you know, they were the breath of the planet and that they needed to be saved, and it was critical. Trees are critical in permaculture and sustainability. Trees are where it all starts. That's why Johnny Appleseed. So that's why, the reason I'm explaining this to you is when I was interviewing Mick Garvin, I knew absolutely nothing about the forest and what was going on. So this was 30 years ago in 1995, almost 30 years ago. Mick Garvin was out there at Warner Creek. I tried to build a greenhouse out there on the road. I tried to farm the road at Warner Creek, and that was what I was known for, and bringing bagels out there from Humble Bagel. I went out there, they were like the Donner Party. I went out there in the spring. No one could get in there because of the snow into Warner Creek. So as soon as the snow broke, I took my Ranchero out there that didn't have four-wheel drive, and brought him a bunch of bagels, and they were there toasting the last of their moldy bagel when I showed up. In this interview, be aware that I don't know what I'm talking about, but there's nothing wrong with that. That's how you learn. That's how you open a dialogue. Mick at first was kind of taken aback because he figured I should be a little more informed at my age, because I was in my 30s, I think, by then. I wasn't a cub reporter. So there is danger that your subject will be insulted or whatever, but I explained to him, hey, I don't know, I'm here to learn, you know. So at that point, and then he was very gracious, and Warner Creek, great, one of the greatest times of my life. That's where the Northwest Forest Plan was started. We tried to stop clear cutting; they wouldn't do it in negotiations, and that was the best we could do for you. So, and here we are. So that's coming up here on Talks Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. We need your support. More wacky, fun, wacky stuff here on Talks Cheap. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. But first, Raven Rock, an excerpt from Raven Rock, the story of the U.S. government's secret plan to save itself while the rest of us die. Hey, I get all my stuff from the Whole Earth Catalog. What can I say? By the score,
all dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Oh, what a lucky man he was, fleece and feathers. They made up his bed, a gold-covered mattress on which he was led. Oh, what a lucky man he was. Oh, what a lucky man he was. He went to fight wars for his country and his king, of his honor and his glory. The people would sing, oh, what a lucky man he was. Oh, what a lucky man he was. A bullet had found him, his blood ran as he cried. No money could save him, so he lay down and he died.
Thank you very much.
When I was a kid, I grew up in L.A. I admit it, I'm a transplant up here. And what you would do is we would hike to the top of Reseda Boulevard, is Mulholland Drive, the Reseda Boulevard. There's these radar towers, and what these were in World War II was they knew 15 minutes early if we were going to be invaded by a plane, by planes, we're going to invade the United States. And if you watch the movie 1941, Spielberg 1941 with John Belushi, you'll see the history of that. So, and the debacle that was. But NORAD, to their credit, they have protected our shores with airplanes since World War II. That's what they do. That's their gig. That's their thing. So this is what they were doing. And I keep hearing this from several different sources that they were doing a continuity of government exercise during 9/11. They just happened to be doing this exercise. So here it is in yet another book where they describe this continuity of government exercise that NORAD was on, and that's why the planes, that's why they couldn't get a 3,000-mile-an-hour plane to fly and intercept the jet planes that crashed into the towers. So, so here it is, chapter 17 from The Story of the U.S. Government's Secret Plan to Save Itself While the Rest of Us Die, by Garrett M. Graff. The irony of September 11, 2001 was that as dawn swept across the United States, the U.S. government was preparing to fight the Cold War all over again. At Cheyenne Mountain, NORAD's overnight shift had been carefully monitoring Russian bombers and fighters near the Arctic Circle as part of Operation Northern Denial. As part of Operation Northern Denial. After a long hiatus, Russia had resumed training flights of its Bear bombers, and as summer had turned to fall, the two nations regularly jockeyed in the airspace off Alaska. That September, the U.S. watched as Russian fighters, Tu-160 Blackjack and Tu-95 Bear bombers, practiced missile attacks and air-to-air refueling. Additionally, NORAD units nationwide had been planning to participate that day in Vigilant Guardian, a large-scale nuclear drill that traced its history back to earlier preparedness exercises like Operation Alert, High Heels, and Spade Fork. The day was scheduled to be busy and high stakes, as the simulated exercise would escalate, as one officer explained, from strained diplomacy to the outbreak of conventional warfare that headed inexorably toward nuclear conflict. The first radio call came in to the Northeast Air Defense Sector, or NEADS, from the civilian FAA Traffic Management Unit in Boston, which announced at 8:37 a.m. Eastern Time, "Hi, Boston Center, TMU. We have a problem here. We have a hijacked aircraft headed towards New York. And we need you guys we need someone to scramble some F-16s or something up there. Help us out." Understandably, there was a good deal of confusion throughout the opening moments of the 9/11 hijacking as word of the crisis arrived at the headquarters for NEADS, an aluminum Cold War era bunker at Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York, which had once been a vital hub for the SAGE early warning system. General LeMay himself had christened the sector's SAGE system in 1958, a then state-of-the-art machine to ensure the warning time necessary to launch COG, or Continuation of Government. But by 2001, the Rome base was a shadow of its Cold War self. The air base's half-buried alert facility where B-52 crews passed the hours waiting for Armageddon, playing billiards, poker, or arcade games like Asteroids or Battlezone, lay abandoned. Air Force Technical Sergeant Jeremy Powell gave the government's first response to the alert, Is this real world or exercise? No, the Boston air traffic controller responded, this is not an exercise, not a test. It was an exchange that would be repeated across the government as news spread. At that same moment in Colorado, around 6:40 a.m. local time, NORAD's overnight shift was wrapping up their day and preparing to hand over the watch at 7 a.m. While normally a quiet shift, NORAD had had many of the facility's top staff working overnight to monitor Operation Northern Denial, which paired up with the daytime maneuvers in Russia. On the surface, it seemed on that particular September morning, NORAD was particularly well-suited to coordinate a crisis response. But as the ensuing hours would show, NORAD and the U.S. government weren't prepared very well at all. Talk about understatement. Following standard hijacking procedure, NEADS ordered into the air two F-15 alert fighters at Massachusetts Otis Air Force Base. Within minutes, their afterburners roaring, the planes were airborne en route to New York City, even as reports began to trickle in of a crash at the World Trade Center. The alert fighters' established mission, as one document later explained, was simply to be there for World War III. But no one expected World War III anytime soon, so the program, which had once boasted more than 60 ready fighters nationwide, had withered to just 14 by September 2001. The two F-15s in Massachusetts, along with another pair of alert F-16 fighters at Langley Air Force Base in Virginia, constituted all of the East Coast air defenses that day. Because the rest of them were on an exercise. NORAD's radars faced outward to track incoming threats, so throughout the day, the air defense sector struggled to tap into the FAA's radars. In fact, Cheyenne Mountain struggled to get news of any kind. All the information we were getting at the time was really off the TV, recalled NORAD official Stephen Armstrong. We were out there in the information void just looking for anything that we could find. At 9:24 a.m., two Langley fighters scrambled as NEADS and NORAD chased reports of another hijacked aircraft headed toward Washington. No one told the Langley pilots why they were being scrambled skyward, and so, not realizing they were chasing civilian hijackings, they followed the normal procedures aimed at intercepting incoming threats heading due east out over the Atlantic Ocean toward an airspace known as Whiskey 386 that was reserved for the military. I reverted to the Russian threat. I'm thinking cruise missile from the sea. You know, you look down and see the Pentagon burning, and I thought, the bastards snuck one by us, one Langley pilot, Craig Borgstrom, told the 9/11 Commission later. No one told us anything. As they finally were rerouted toward the Capitol, one of the Langley pilots heard an urgent request from the Secret Service, protect the house. The Secret Service major concern at 9 a.m. over, as the 9 a.m. hour unfolded, was securing the White House and the man first in line for succession to the presidency. Continuity of government. Not only do we spend billions of dollars on these buildings, but they keep changing their continuity of government plan, so that costs billions of dollars. And Dick Cheney, of course, is very up on the continuity of, and is ready at a moment's notice to jump in to the continuity of government plan. So, that's what was going on 9/11. Our airplanes were in an exercise. And like I say, I keep finding these little tidbits of information about this. Because it's very difficult to find anything about NORAD. They have all kinds of stuff about the bombs in the World Trade Center that are supposedly in the World Trade Center, but not much. Why weren't the planes there that are supposed to do exactly, or almost exactly what the problem was. Okay, so KEPW, Eugene Peaceworks, low power FM, 97.3 FM.
I'm trying to do this the best way here. KEPW 97.3, Eugene Peaceworks Low Power FM. Show's talk is cheap. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Coming up, Tim Ream and then Mick Garvin. Literally out on the blocking the Forest Road. I went out there and recorded him on the Forest Road. And I'll tell you more about that. I knew nothing about what I was doing. So, but it still came out a pretty good interview. But I was new. I knew there was a problem with the forest up here, but I didn't know exactly what was going on. Turns out, they just implemented the forest plan. So that's coming up here on Talk is Cheap. Because Dick Cheney, we really don't know why Vlad the Impaler and Dick Cheney are never in the same place. So this is an answer to that question: why Dick Cheney and Vlad the Impaler are never in the same place.
illusion themselves. There is a throwing off of a human-centered value system and a taking on of a life-centered value system. And people are doing this as individuals all around the country, and what they need to do is realize that it's going on all over the country. It's not just a few individuals that this is happening for. I find, especially among college students and younger people, there are lots and lots of people out there that just believe, and they express it through the way they dress, they express it through the kind of houses that they want to live in the future, they express it through the diet that they eat, their resistance to want to have fossil fuel-driven transportation and so on, that they want to go look for a different alternative to this society that they feel is destructive of so much of our natural ecosystem. And by educating each other, we can educate each other as to what we replace this society with, because when we get right down to it, the way our parents taught us to live is plain old, not sustainable. We can't just keep this lifestyle of high consumption, which is basically predicated on the fact that the United States has a military that's structured to fight two major wars at the same time, and if somebody even threatens our trading partner's oil, we can blow up 150,000 Iraqis to make certain that oil continues to flow to support our high consumptive lifestyle.
Go ahead, Kurt.
Well, getting back to you were talking about the diseases in the forest, and that gives them a reason to cut stuff down. Isn't a tree farm is a monoculture, and if a disease goes in there, it's going to spread really fast.
Yeah, there is a forest health crisis. The forest health crisis is clear-cutting, spraying, and the destruction of the native forest ecosystem that was always there. There's a strength in diversity. If you have a lot of different species, and you have those species represented by a variety of different ages, which is sometimes referred to as multiple species, multiple age types of forests, then when an insect comes in, it usually prefers a single type of species, and it usually can only attack a certain age within that species. So if you have a disease that, for instance, attacks middle-age Douglas fir trees, the western hemlocks are fine, the yew are fine, the cedar are fine, the old Douglas fir are fine, the very young Douglas fir are fine. And so you lose a part of your stand, but the forest itself maintains a lot of strength and integrity. If you have a stand of trees that are all middle-age Douglas fir trees, and that insect or that disease starts to attack one of them, and the very next tree over is another one that can attack, it can spread very quickly, and it can destroy an entire stand. And that is the kind of situation we are setting up on the vast majority, certainly of our private forests, and also now on our public forests, so that all of our public forests are just becoming tree farms. And I think we're going to find in our tree farming the same thing we found in our corn farming in the Midwest in the 1930s.
They're all going to get wiped out at once?
All the soil is going to go away. It might not be a dust bowl. It might just be a mud bowl. It
might be Soviet Uzbekistan, where they monocropped cotton, and now it's all chemicals.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, there's a petition going around now that would hopefully we could put into law protections that would outlaw clear cutting and use of pesticides in the forests with certain exceptions. Do you feel that this is that this petition is tight enough? Are there loopholes in it? Would it really do what needs to be done?
Well, I've heard a few different analyses of it, and I'm not a lawyer myself. I've read through the initiative. It sounds to me like it would be a wonderful step forward for the state of Oregon. Now, for that to happen, first of all, enough Oregon voters have to sign one of these petitions that basically, in a nutshell, the petition bans clear-cutting as a forestry practice. That's not banning the cutting of all trees, but just banning the practice of clear-cutting. It mandates a certain amount of trees per acre that have to be left behind, and it bans the spraying of herbicide on forests. And it's far-reaching because it applies to federal lands, state lands, county lands, and private lands. And I would love to see it get enough signatures that it can be on the ballot and leave it up to all of the voters of the state of Oregon. And if it does get on the ballot, you can be assured that the timber companies will spend a huge amount of money taking out advertisements in newspapers, magazines, and especially on television to assure you that this would just be the death of Oregon. And I think, of course, the death of Oregon is clear-cutting and spraying, and it would be a return to life for Oregon if this ballot initiative ultimately passed.
Do you have another question?
No, that's it. Thanks.
All right, thanks for the call. Peter?
I have a question for you, Tim. Is there money in environmental organizations enough to market the values that certain organizations want to espouse to the public? I mean, you have timber companies who pay people to market to a given group of people, a target audience. Is there that same type of process going on?
Well, I find that with the big national Washington organizations, money certainly attracts a kind of person that wants to manage that money. So when environmental organizations in the 80s and especially around 1990 really grew in size because of the increasing consciousness around the need to protect our environment, that the kind of stands that those organizations were taking were not always the strongest stands that you'd want an organization to take. On the timber issue, for instance, most Americans are against cutting any trees that are left on our federal forests. They view that our federal forests are in a serious state of decline and that what we must do is keep our hands off of commercial extraction of timber. And that's the way most Americans feel. In fact, that's shown by polls taken by the Forest Service. Most major national environmental organizations don't espouse that view. But there is one organization, the Sierra Club, that has, as the way it is structured, it's structured as a club. And so the members of the club have an opportunity to affect club policy. A local activist by the name of Chad Hansen, who often works with the Native Forest Council, which is based here in Eugene, spent about 3.5 years, along with some other forest activists around the country, trying to get the club to allow members to vote on this issue. And recently he got it on the ballot. And this spring, Sierra Club members voted, and they voted by a margin of more than 2-1 to endorse what is sometimes referred to as zero cut. That is, no commercial extraction of timber on national forest land. So it has now become the policy of the Sierra Club that regardless of what their weak board of directors might say, regardless of what their weak executive director might say, it is now a policy, according to the people who are contributing members to the club, that this club will endorse no commercial extraction of timber on federal lands. And so this is a wonderful thing. If we can get the Audubon Society and the Wilderness Society and Greenpeace and other organizations like this to start following suit, that is all we need these organizations to do is follow the lead of the average John and Jane Doe that are sitting home and want to see these places protected. And so the kind of money they have can be very powerful if it's put to the right use. Unfortunately, up until now, many of these organizations are advocating for very weak positions, and that's why I'm much more in favor of contributing both time and money to, wherever possible, grassroots organizations.
But wait a minute. If we don't build houses, what are we going to build houses with if we don't if we don't cut down forests? What are we going to build them with?
What are we going to sit on?
Yeah, what are we going to... Well, we don't want to get into what else we use paper for.
There will always be a role in our society for using products that are made out of wood. There's no doubt about that. And as I pointed out earlier, 88% of our wood products, both paper and timber, come from private lands. And there is not a need right now with our public lands under such an assault to spend a whole lot of time discussing the issue of private lands, especially here in the West, where so much of our lands are under the management of the Bureau of Land Management and the National Forest. The public's best chance to affect the ecosystem is by trying to affect public lands. There are alternatives, of course. I mean, certainly people know that paper does not have to be made out of virgin stock. Of course, paper can be made out of post-consumer recycled fiber, but it can also be made out of agricultural waste, knauf, hemp, and these substances make beautiful types of paper. Hemp and knauf especially make a wonderful, sturdy kind of paper that can be recycled many times more than a wood fiber paper.
Constitution was written on hemp.
That's right.
You have a cob house in your backyard.
Right.
This house is made out of mud.
There are all kinds of wonderful alternatives to building with wood.
It's beautifully done. It doesn't look like a mud hut. It's a beautiful architecture that an architectural student here at the U of O...
Yeah.
Doesn't he go here?
Right.
Design this thing.
And that that building is just one example. I mean, people are building earth ships. They're building out of straw bale. The alternative that I find most beautiful, most easy to work with, and the least expense, and the probably the most ecologically sound, is cob. It's simply an unfired adobe. It's a mixture of earth, sand, and straw that are mixed together oftentimes by just taking off your boots and mushing them up with your feet and applied directly to a wall, and you get beautiful round organic shapes and arches and alcoves and ledges and benches.
All throughout the Northwest where it rains for days on end, months on end.
You know, of course, England is a rainy place, and there are cob buildings in England that are 500 years old. So multi-story, multi-room houses that... are made out of cob. So cob is a time-tested way of building. It's being used here in the Pacific Northwest in ways that maybe it hasn't been used before. And to a large extent, that's being spearheaded by a group that's right here in Cottage Grove, a group called the Cobb Cottage Company. And if I remember right, their phone number is 942 942- 2005, and they have both free work days where you can just go and experience a work day by giving them your labor for a day. You learn how to build with Cobb, and they also have workshops where you can pay to attend a workshop. So just you can give them a call if you want to learn more about Cobb. It's 942-2005. Oh, and also they take free tours of people around the Cobb buildings in the area on Fridays and Saturdays. So just by calling them up, you can find out about that.
Also, they go to whole other countries where they're building them.
Oh, sure. These Cobb workshops are being held all over the world.
That you can go to. Well, we have to end Campus Talk. Is there anything?
All right, that was recorded. Tim just gives a couple of announcements that happened back in 1994. So that was recorded when I had a show, a brief stint over at KWVA. The U of O radio station that I helped, sort of helped start over there. I don't know if they would give me credit for that. All right, so coming up, Mick Garvin recorded right out on the road, blocking the road at Warner Creek in 1994. Still poignant to this day. We still haven't solved it. And you can hear Cindy, who became his wife later. A little ambiance.
Okay. Testing. Okay, I'm talking with...
What?
She's a lady. She's the lady.
I'm no lady.
No, I did say you were a lady.
I know.
Okay, I'm talking with Mick Garvin. He's blocking the road here in the middle of the Willamette Forest of Warner Creek area. Why are you blocking the road to the Willamette Forest?
Let's see. Boils down to this is the first of a number of salvage sales released under the rider. This one in particular was a habitat conservation area, one of the designations under the Clinton Forest Plan, that offered it quite a bit of protection, the spotted owl habitat, and then it was arsoned. And the argument we feel here is that arson is no way to open an area up to be salvaged. And there's salvage issues as well, but in this case, it's a bad precedent to set to allow salvage logging to take place if a place is deliberately burned.
And have they done this before? Has arson been a reason to salvage an area before?
Any fire is a reason to salvage. Now, with the Congress's interpretation of salvage, not only burned trees or diseased trees or dead trees are considered salvage, but trees in association with them, green life, healthy trees that may become at some time threatened with fire or bug infestation, which means just about anything. And this goes throughout the national forest lands with the sole exception of the designated wilderness areas, which make up a very, very small percentage of land and certainly are mostly rock and ice and not viable timber to begin with, or they'd never have seen a wilderness designation. The attempts we've made to have some of these roadless areas, such as the one we're concerned with here, the Corn Patch Roadless Area, attached to existing wilderness, have been constantly thwarted by people who feel that they should be able to continue to log in those regions, take out what's left there. Go ahead.
Here, I'm trying to think. So they're actually taking live trees out of... Why do they need to take live trees out of a burned area?
They can come up with a number of different reasons.
They're going to be diseased?
Forest health is the new scam. Yes, fear of another fire, fear of a bug outbreak. I hear constantly that these trees are threatened by bugs, yet the people I've talked with, such as Dr. Partridge out of the University of Idaho, who's a plant pathologist, said, you know, has come onto the record saying that things like the spruce budworm infestations on the east side and pine bark beetle, these are cyclical things, and that right now there are no live cases of bug infestation in most of these diseased regions. It came during a stress time for the forest, heavy drought. As the trees regained strength, those that had not been infected at that time were more resistant, and the cycle goes on the way it usually does.
Well, also a monoculture, doesn't it spread faster when there's only one type of tree?
If there's one type of tree and there's one bug in the neighborhood that just loves that type of tree, yes, the tree plantation is about the worst place for one of those breed of trees to survive.
So you're better off having a diverse forest. Is this old growth or is this second growth here?
This has been high graded. There are a number of trees in here that are probably 400, 500, 600 years old, but you'll also go through most of this area and find stumps of large trees. It's been gone through once at least in this region we're sitting on right now.
But it still retains its diversity?
In the areas that it hasn't been touched within the last, say, 10, 15 years, where you see most of these patches, this was most of it done within the late 70s and the 80s, a lot of it in the 80s, clear cut after clear cut after clear cut.
Yeah.
Prior to the 70s and feller bunchers and really hardcore mechanized industrial scale logging, was done a lot more light-handedly, especially if it was a small private company that was working private lands. They tended to treat the land somewhat
more
gently. Well, I'd say conservatively. They had it in mind that they'd want to keep doing it and didn't have this very crop-oriented attitude towards just cutting the whole thing down and then replanting it and getting 40 to 60 year rotations through these forests.
Now, you said the other day that they're going to die in 23 years anyway. Not all the trees die at the same time, do they?
No, I was making a joke about the people who are involved in all these actions. Most of them are old men, and you know, in 23 years, by and large, most of the people that have authored the legislation that has brought us to this point are going to be gone. Their legacy after the next 5 years will remain probably through the lives of their great-grandchildren. I hope their great-grandchildren can stand their family tree.
So would you object to selective logging in here?
In a lot of these areas, especially now the way that the forests have been so badly hammered, I would really look with a guarded eye on any kind of logging in the national lands. If they want to prove to me that they can go back and start working in a forest, then let them start on private lands that have been so badly abused, and let this recover. If anything needs to be taken out, I would like to see it not done on a commercial basis, but on the basis of getting an imbalanced monocrop tree plantation to start showing those types of variety that you want, taking out, thinning it, planting a new layer in there to give it multiple layered canopy over the years, and letting it come back into joining the rest of the areas that have much more diversity to them, and reestablish, you know, large sections of areas where the animals and the plants that inhabit these places, when they're left alone, can reestablish themselves, transmit their genetic material back and forth, you know, north and south, east and west. I'd really like to see grizzly bear back in California someday, down to Mexico. No, I don't think they need to go about experimenting on how they're going to get a cut out of a national forest when they've done so badly so far. I'd like to see them do it on private land first. Sure.
A friend of mine, his cousin is a logger, and I asked him. What his complaint is that we leave trees that are going to die anyway, just let them sit there and die. What is the advantage of that? Is there a reason for that?
Well, is there a reason for a person, once they're past 55 or 60 and their muscles start to go, you know, leaving them as a part of your culture? This is a whole system. It requires everything right up to and including death and decay.
The forest needs dead trees in it.
Yeah, these trees, if you're taking this from an anthropocentric point of view that sees nothing but resources that can be utilized by humans, and if they aren't resources that can be utilized by humans, they have very little worth. One resource you might say would be scenic beauty. You know, but if we find it ugly, and we can't feed it to one of our animals, and we can't eat it ourselves, we can't build a house out of it, we care very little for it. These things have value to the system they exist in, far beyond any value they hold for us.
Yeah, but these systems are for us to enjoy. I mean, we're not for us to enjoy. What am I trying to say? We're, you know, they're necessary for our survival, these systems, and therefore
a dead tree is necessary for our survival. My survival hinges in these places. Perhaps people are doing their best to inure themselves to a life that they will have to live in 20, 30 years when these places don't exist. I don't intend to get that bruised and calloused in my life. I think that, yes, our survival as whole humans really depends on the survival of a whole natural world, that without these things we are less than what we were before.
We're part of a cycle.
Yeah. I mean, we're not apart from nature. We may have driven ourselves away from it or driven it away from us for whatever reason. But
well, we never need to conquer nature, maybe a stewardship of nature rather than trying to conquer it.
I think just living within it and taking the things that you really need to survive, and at the same time not damaging things so that everything else that's sharing those spaces with you is likewise offered the opportunity to go along, eat, drink, you know, walk about. God, this isn't the way it is right now.
Well, things are sacred. Things could be a little more sacred and not so much waste.
True. Yeah, I don't know. Sacred is a word for everybody to have their interpretations of. In a Christian culture, it's somewhat amazing that this could be seen as something that was just handed over to people to take what they wanted out of and leave whatever waste behind destroyed. This is supposed to be the work of their God, and yet we seem to see just the trees that we want out of it, and in taking them, should we drive any other creation of that God into extinction? Well, that's supposed to be just peachy. It baffles me about this culture sometimes that this is the way they act when they are predominantly Christian. I don't.
Yeah, how can you do this to God's work?
That's up to the Christians to decide how they can accept living in a society that acts this way. I don't choose to accept that sort of behavior, and that's why we're sitting here.
So how much longer do you think the Forest Service is going to let you sit here and do this?
Well, that's a real good question. Tell you, if you could ask the Forest Service that and they give you a straight answer and you come back up and tell me,
you'd like
obliged
to know too. Well, you guys said you're expecting them any time, is what I thought.
We try to be in a position where we're not going to be surprised. Mm-hmm. Whether or not they do show up tomorrow morning, or whether we really believe that there's good odds that they would, we're just going to try and be ready. And
but how long do they have before they can, well, they can still log it?
Until August of next year. And then the contract expires with Thomas Creek, and they could probably sell it again. But
they can't log in the winter.
They could fall the trees in the winter. They know they couldn't haul them out, but they could drop a falling team in here by helicopter or have them come in by snowmobile.
Do they do that often?
They do it, at least bringing them in by snowmobile. They've done that up in Idaho.
Do they do that to circumvent, should I call you eco-terrorism, or should I?
Terrorist is when somebody puts a bomb underneath some environmentalist's chair in their car, and they wind up with their guts hanging around their neck. This, I don't know, you might say we're engaged in heavy civil disobedience. Somebody may be accused of vandalism at some point in time, but I really hate when people hang the word terrorist up next to our picture or mention it when they talk about the actions that are going on up here. Terrorism is an entirely different ballgame. It's a loaded word that polarizes people and raises temperatures. And we've experienced enough violence in the time we've been working for these sorts of things.
So this is a non-violent action.
A non-violent campaign.
And but what I'm getting at is, do they come in here and log in the winter just to circumvent civil disobedience actions?
That may be one motivation for them doing it here. I'm not familiar with any kind of practice like that done here in areas where it's heavy snow. It's just a practicality. You can dig out a tree, fall it, it falls into soft material, and then you spend the months that the roads are clear of snow yarding out your timber and dragging it down the hill. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's an effective use of time. They don't usually do it out here, as far as I've seen, perhaps because they don't have the snow season that Idaho has.
What can you say to loggers? I mean, aren't the loggers going to lose their job anyway when all this timber is gone? Isn't it the timber companies that aren't they doing a disservice to these loggers, because they could be, I mean, instead of pulling it all out at once, they could be pulling out of here slowly and keep people in jobs instead of taking it out all at once.
They could have done that 40 or 50 years ago. I don't know if you started them to piecemeal taking trees now. A lot of people aren't going to be satisfied because they've just taken too much.
So if we started 40 years ago doing that, they all might still keep their jobs for another 40 years, maybe.
To an extent, I mean, any population that's crowded is going to have its, I don't want to say die-offs, but that's basically it. If you have too many people trying to make a living off of a limited resource, whether it's black-tailed deer eating up the northeast seaboard, or it's people all trying to make a living falling trees when things were very rich 10 years ago, when these things were coming out in the billion board foot sales, there's going to be some people that are going to have to find a new way to make a life.
Maybe planting trees rather than cutting them down.
A lot of us do planting trees. A lot of us do other jobs related to the forest. It doesn't mean leave the forest, but as far as logging goes, I mean, they should have been addressing and should still try to address things like mechanization and exports.
Well, what I'm getting at is, isn't it more labor-intensive and therefore provides more jobs to do selective logging rather than a clear cut? A clear cut is hardly labor-intensive at all, is it?
Not with the feller buncher, it's not. You got two people on, you know, the crew, and they just go in and knock it down like we should.
And that's it, two people. So there's only two jobs.
And it's not very, it doesn't take very long either. And it works really well in a tree plantation.
Whereas a selective cut would take weeks maybe to do the same space.
And you'd need higher trained personnel, people that really know how to bring down a tree properly.
That would have to be paid more.
Yeah. I mean, the fallers nowadays are paid very little. They mostly don't have the certification. They couldn't get the certification if they wanted it nowadays, because the trees that they would have to be skilled at bringing down, they don't bring down anymore because they've wiped them out.
Okay, this is good stuff. This is what I want. All right, so what? Anything else that we haven't covered?
No, you can think for a while, though, and talk to others.
Flesh and steel I want, drying in the corner of the evening sun. Tomorrow's rain will wash the stains away, but something in my mind will always stay. Perhaps this final act was meant to clinch a lifetime's argument, that nothing comes from violence. Nothing of a core for all those born beneath an angry star. Lest we forget how fragile.